Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We begin our program with a study from Wuhan Polytech University in China. And it's a study that evaluated the effect of the flavonoid lutein, L-U-T-E-O-L-I-N, in a mouse model of Alzheimer's disease, and it resulted in improvement in cognitive deficit and other factors associated with the disease. So this is an important study. It was 8 weeks where the mice took lutein every day at what comparable to what a human would take. And the behavioral tests were conducted at the end of the treatment period, and the animals' brains were examined. Mice that received lutein had less cognitive impairment compared with untreated Alzheimer's disease mice. Now, I've worked with a lot of people with Alzheimer's and dementia, and Alzheimer's is just a form of dementia. And I approach it a little differently. I certainly respect this study's outcome, but I start with the idea of what causes Alzheimer's, dementia. In fact, what is the primary cause or causes of most illnesses? That's where you should start. Not just at the symptoms, the end stage of a disease. In fact, when someone says, you're lucky they caught it early, well, if they just found a tumor, that might have taken 30 years to develop. So prevention is the key. And therefore, all of the bioflavonoids, all of the polyphenols, in other words, when you have a full rainbow of fruits and vegetables each day, and hopefully about, ideally in my opinion, 9 servings. A lot of that can be done in juices, but we're not. Most Americans are lucky to get 1 serving of fruits and vegetables per day because we're so used to eating processed foods, fast foods, and the makers of these fast foods don't make their money off salads and fruit bowls. So make sure you're getting your fruits and vegetables because that turns off inflammation. And inflammation is the underlying progenitor or cause of the vast majority of diseases, cancers, diabetes, arthritis, fibromyalgia. Yeah. So when you turn off the illness at its cause, then you start giving the brain and body what it needs to rebuild. That's the right combination. So there's a amyloid beta, a sticky protein that forms plaques in the brain of Alzheimer's disease patients in the hippocampi of their brains. This is all involved with memory. And the amyloid beta generation and accumulation was also reduced with lutein-treated cultural neurons derived from Alzheimer's mice. So the polyphenols, more fruits and vegetables, carrots, plums, watermelon, all these are good, all right? And the study clearly demonstrated for the first time that lutein administration was able to alleviate the cognitive deficits. So if it could eliminate it in people with advanced Alzheimer's, how about just taking this on a daily basis to prevent it, right? Something else we can prevent, and that is being able to not have feet based upon the wrong-fitting shoes and stylish shoes that cause all kinds of problems. University of Washington now has found that barefoot is better, and the modern-day shoes are unhealthy. I would agree. So anytime I'm able, I walk around. It's called grounding, you know, just with your feet right on the dirt, right on the grass. And it's very soothing. It's good. And by the way, I always spray once a week diatomaceous earth. I take a real little grass seeder and it whips out the diatomaceous earth, which is fossilized material. And little insects, from ticks to spiders, they cross that and it cuts them and they dehydrate. I haven't seen a tick in 27 years here. No ticks and no fleas. And yet the first day I was here with my brother, because I bought this place for him, as I'm sitting there, I'm noticing that there are about 15 sand fleas on the owner's legs, and he's got all these little red marks. And I said, do you mind? Oh, well, you just get used to it. I said, why didn't you use diatomaceous earth? It's non-toxic and it'll kill him. No, it's too much bother. Well, it wouldn't bother me, and I suggest you do the same. In any case, by walking barefoot, of course, pay attention. I don't want you cutting your foot. I don't want any cuts or nicks. I don't want anything that's out there getting into your blood. So just be conscious of this. And anyhow, if you walk barefoot, not only saves your children's feet from poor foot formation as they grow, but also helps improve overall health for them and you as an adult. And there have been many studies supporting both areas of concern. This was published in Pediatrics by the Department of Orthopedics, Children's Hospital Medical Center in Seattle, and the Department of Orthopedics, University of Washington, Seattle. And so just something to think about. All right. In fact, when I used to live in South Beach, I would go for a 10-mile run in the morning on the beach. No one else was out there. Occasionally, I'd see someone doing yoga, but it was empty. And you just felt great. And they clean up the beach every day. They take bulldozers in there and scrape it because you don't know what's in the sand. A needle from someone who's been shooting heroin, you don't know. But be smart. And walk barefoot as much as you can. Ginkgo biloba, one of the oldest herbs known, may enhance performance, boost your brain health for active men. This is according to the scientists at Poznan University in Poland. Simply stated, extracts of ginkgo biloba leaves may offer body and mind benefits for young active men. All right, so 160 milligrams a day of a standardized extract of ginkgo biloba for 6 weeks was associated with improvement in maximal oxygen uptake and blood antioxidant capacity, and that's important. All right, and this was published at the Academy of Physical Education in the Poznan University of Physical Education. And by the way, it was also in Nutrients, the peer-reviewed journal. I share that with you just in case any of the scientists or health professionals want to do more research on it. They can find it. Now, Columbia University School of Public Health did a study on high blood and urine metal levels. And guess who had the highest? People who used marijuana on a regular basis. Now, again, let's not confuse the issue. Let's keep it in proper context. I believe, and I've said this for 50 years of my career since I began, we should legalize all drugs for a lot of reasons. A, you could then help people understand why are you taking the drug to begin with and help them at the primal level. B, you could set up clinics. We had one at Trafalgar Hospital, and I headed it for a long time. I helped thousands of people, but I was using protocols that were not drugs. We didn't use methadone, and yet that was the number one, you know, use of getting people off heroin by using methadone. No, I used high B complex, and I used specific nutrients that I knew would impact the brain. And almost all the time, when you're finding someone who's doing one illicit drug, they have a lot of bad health habits. When we take samples of their blood and examine it, it looked like a sewer. And so what is the point of giving a clean needle for a dirty drug? That's just insane. And that's the entire scientific community, in my opinion. God, the longer you're in science, the more you realize how unscientific these people are. In any case, most. In fact, research conducted at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health detected significant levels of heavy metals in the blood and urine among marijuana users, concluding that marijuana may be an important and under-recognized source of lead and cadmium exposure, and that can cause kidney failure, liver toxicity, damage your heart, and really mess up the neurons in the brain because it's not easy to get heavy metals out of the body, all right? Sometimes they lodge in fat. So yes, if you got rid of all illicit drugs, then the cartels are not going to be able to make money off those. They'll find some other way to make money, but not the money they've made off drugs and not the power they've had to corrupt the police in Mexico and all the other countries, terrorize people, and commit a modern-day genocide. So, You get clinics to help people and use humanistic psychological practices also to deal with issues that led them to do these things. But then you take everyone who's in jail for drug use and you let them out, clean their records, let them start over. All right? Otherwise, you should challenge arresting George Bush Jr., Bill Clinton, Barack Obama. They all acknowledged in their autobiographies they used drugs. And then they put down laws that were so draconian that millions of people were arrested because of them. Is there any sense of hypocrisy here that the emperor has no clothes? So let me just summarize. I believe that drugs should not be made illegal. We've created cottage industries making billions, hundreds of billions of dollars for governmental agencies and for corporations. At the same time, we've done nothing whatsoever to lessen the use of harmful pharmaceuticals and illicit drugs. Look at all the fentanyl. Why not talk to people using fentanyl? Why not have a national survey, an honest one, where we have clinics where people can get help if they choose to? But then again, I support all the research on tens of thousands of studies showing the active ingredient in cannabis, the cannabinoids, can really help with seizures, brain cancer, lung cancers, I mean, so many things, but that's in a medicinal, high-quality, purified form. And yet, almost everyone I know has used marijuana, and three of my friends used it a lot. And they were kind of always kind of happy and laid back, and they all ended up dying young and not being able to take care of themselves. In fact, it got so bad that one of my closest friends, his son, called me. He said, Gary, can you do something with my dad? He's paranoid, delusional, and schizophrenic and psychotic. Brought him in from Hawaii. And within 2 hours, my buddy, while I was making lunch for him, drove at the airport, got on a plane, flew back. He didn't want to change. And he didn't. I can't help people who don't want to be helped. I cannot push a rope up a hill, nor can you. But we're there if they want our help. Anyhow, there are a lot of people who now recognize, and the science is overwhelming, you start using marijuana, you will develop paranoia, delusional psychoses, and it can be permanent. In my friends, it was permanent. All right? And this article was published in Environmental Health Perspectives. So there are ways of detoxifying using chelation therapy and lots of chlorophyll. Chlorella, spirulina, wheatgrass powder. These certainly help along with intravenous vitamin C. Now, from Stony Brook University, the brain's pathway clears harmful waste, especially during sleep. This lateral position could prove to be the best position for brain waste clearance processes. Sleeping in the lateral or side positions are compared to sleeping on one's back or stomach may more effectively remove brain waste and prove to be an important practice to help reduce the chance of developing Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and other neurological diseases. That's what the Stony Brook University shows. So, you know, they did MRIs, they imaged the brain's pathway, a complex system that clears waste and other harmful chemical solutions out of the brain. And they found that a lateral sleeping position is the best position to most efficiently remove waste from the brain. All right, just something you can think about. And finally, from the University of Maryland School of Public Health, regular energy drink use, a lot of Americans use energy drinks, is linked to later drug use among young adults. So, that question, could young adults who regularly consume highly caffeinated energy drinks be at risk of future substance abuse? Yes. A new study from University of Maryland School of Public Health, published in the journal Drug and Alcohol Dependence, suggests that there is reason for concern. They found that young adults, during a 5-year period, ages 21 to 25, those who used energy drinks, including caffeinated beverages like coffee, sustain that consumption over time were significantly more likely to use cocaine, non-medically used prescription stimulants, and be at risk of alcohol use disorder or other drugs. I've seen this, weaning people off in a detox protocol from energy drinks and caffeine. It takes time, but it's important you know how to do it, because a person is going to go through withdrawal, and some of this withdrawal is extreme. And I've seen people go to all kinds of lengths to try to get that caffeine back in their body. Not good. So it also means that if you are taking a lot of caffeine, and that's more than 100 milligrams, and that's probably half the American population, but truck drivers, cab drivers, people working night shift, they can take 400 or 500 milligrams. I know people that have taken 1,000 milligrams, and my doctoral dissertation was on caffeinism. So I did laboratory work, I did clinical work, and on my thesis, and it was published in a peer-reviewed journal. But wow, knowing how to get them off is the key. And you need someone who's disciplined. Most people are not, because if they were disciplined, they wouldn't be doing the damn stuff to begin with. So let's get over this idea of hoorah, rah, new age nonsense, because that's what it is, all nonsense. It is. You know, if you're going to do something, someone's not going to talk you into doing it. You have to talk yourself into doing it. Now, you can read books, and I know people that read a lot of books and do nothing that's in the book, not on a philosophical level, not on a practical level. But they think that they're smarter because they got it up here, right? It's in this cranium somewhere. Also, people who will listen to the show on a regular basis think that I'm healthy. I listen to Gary Noll's show. Do you do any of the things Gary suggests? Well, not right now. I will. How long have you been listening? Just 30 years. God, you have no idea. I'm willing to state this on the record, that I would challenge that there's no more than 5% of the people listening to this program or watching it as I'm Zoom streaming this, who actually are very healthy, very happy, because they're in control of their life and the circumstances surrounding it. 95% pretend. It's like, as long as I listen to Gary, I can't be that sick. Yeah, you can be. And I can show you a lot of people who listen. That doesn't make him a bad person. It's not a judgment on, it's an observation. All right? I'm making an observation that when a person stops me on the street and says, Gary, listen every day, keep up those exposés, I really like them. And he's smoking a cigarette and he's drinking a cola. And I said, when you listen to the show, do you try to practice any of the things? Have you gone to any demonstrations? Have you boycotted any manufacturers or the New York Times, people that dispel disinformation? I get you. I hear what you're saying. Now, how long have you been listening? Get this, 45 years. 45 years. You haven't been to a demonstration. You haven't protested. You're not eating anything healthy. So it's an observation that we're not what we believe. We're not what we talk about or what we do. That's very important to distinguish the two. Otherwise, people are just kidding themselves. You know, how many people have gone to one of Wayne Dyer, one of the other lectures? The lecture may have been completely legitimate, but did people actually go home and change anything in their life? More often than not, the answer is no. I'd like to see people actually change. So if you're on caffeine, the likelihood is you're going to go from caffeine to alcohol or other drugs. And we've got an awful lot of addicts in the United States who don't recognize they're addicted. And then what does the first thing an addict do? Draws attention to themselves. They're loud, they're boisterous, and they pathologically lie. Because you got to lie to yourself so you can convince yourself you're doing the right thing in order to convince other people to trust you. Well, take your time thinking about these things, because we have an awful lot of people in our lives who shouldn't be there, in my opinion, because have they proven to you by first proving to themselves that being in your life is a gift. My being in someone's life is a gift. The person's given me the gift of sharing whatever moment you can, for as long as you can. How can any of that gift be recognized if we begin by lying to ourselves? We have accepted our illusion of who we are, the image of who we are, and not the reality of who we are. Well, that's it for the beginning of our program. We're going to take a break because we have a lot more to share. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. I'd like to focus upon a few things today. And tomorrow I have a really interesting clip of the person I consider the most courageous journalist in mainstream and cable news in America. He is putting everything on the line to tell the truth about what and who's he accusing of lying. It's a very interesting clip. I reviewed it. I reviewed what he had to say, and he is 100% accurate on everything he says. That'll be tomorrow. And by the way, on Monday, I'm going to wish you all a very safe and happy and joyful Labor Day, and I'll be here. I'm going to do a special. I'm going to do a special just on the middle class, because in my opinion, the middle class has been abused, has been denigrated. The black middle class, the Latino middle class, the Asian middle class, and the Caucasian middle class. Doesn't matter. Your color doesn't matter to these people. They want it to matter to you so they can keep everyone balkanized. But everything they could do to betray your trust, they've done, those in power. It's just that now they have so much power and they have so much control over government agencies, the Justice Department, the CIA, the FBI, all the media, and all the government agencies. There are some honest people. I'm not condemning everyone as being corrupted or compromised in a position of an agency. But the vast majority of people in the agencies see what's wrong and don't speak up. All the more reason why we should really respect the courage it takes for a person to become a whistleblower and risk it all. And yet, the very media who praised those like Daniel Ellsberg and were with him, later would praise the agencies that attacked him, hiring heads of the National Security Agency and the CIA and Homeland Security, hiring the very predators who are embedded to run these agencies for the benefit of those in ultra power. We had 71% of the American population in the 1960s who were middle class and thriving. No debt, no credit cards, no cell phones, no computers, or interface computers we have today. And yet we thrived. We weren't perfect, but we were coming through a great event. People speaking up on behalf of gay rights and women's rights and environmental rights, animal rights, human rights. For those of us who were not afraid to go down to the South African embassy and protest in silence, knowing we could be arrested, but still it was important. Even though the people we were protesting on would never know our names or faces, but at least we knew that we were doing something. The same is true for all the other rights. Isn't it interesting now that many of those people who are now baby boomers are now looking at the very agencies of oppression as being the good people, not to be challenged. Trust everything they say. Let them decide what is disinformation. Well, here's where we're going to start. There's a new article out and about how Robert Kennedy Jr. has been a lifelong vaccine denier and an autism denier, etc. And their disinformation specialty organization. And the mainstream media saying, ah, see, such and such says Robert Kennedy lies. So I decided, let's see if they're accurate. So I took months and spent thousands of hours doing research. And it's now posted on GaryNall.com, a three-part series, because it's an article with all the references. It's over 265 pages. When was the last time you saw an article that was that long? That's longer than most books. And we had four of us working on it. Katie, our research editor, Richard Gale, Helen. Helen did her work about 4 years ago, and myself. And the conclusions are that autism clearly, in the vast majority of cases, can be shown not to be genetic, that's where they want to pin it, but rather environmental. And of all the environmental things, it is on vaccines that were the major culprit, proven by all the scientific articles in the peer-reviewed journals that nobody wants to look at, but I assembled them all in one place. So now we sent this over to Robert Kennedy and Dennis Kucinich, his campaign manager, and Mary Holland, who runs the Children's Health Fund. Well, the good news is that Global Research is publishing and featuring, and by the way, Global Research is probably the best platform in the world as far as allowing scholars, lots of professors and PhDs in different fields, to bring forth information that challenges the government and corporate interest on a lot of topics. And we're featured now in a three-part series. That means millions of people are going to be aware of this. What they choose to do with the information is up to them. But just understand the people you've been trusting, believing, and understandably so, have lied to you constantly. So then when is it your responsibility to realize that virtually everything you've been promised, you've been denied? All the freedoms they want you to have, they've taken away. You pay for a completely corrupt government at every level, in every department, including this stupid war in Ukraine, and especially Sean Penn. Sean's a very good actor. I like his films. But Sean, before you go do a terrible piece of propaganda supporting Ukraine, and why don't you do your homework with someone other than the idiots in Hollywood? Idiots in Hollywood. Idiots in Hollywood. Who have no scholarship, know nothing about anything except how their agent can get them a bigger film contract. Oh, but I forgot. Socialism for the actors under them, and ultra-capitalism for those who lead a picture. What hypocrisy. They know nothing about what is going on in Ukraine, the background of it. Try some of the people who are real scholars in the field. The information is there. It's not hidden. Wow, that's where we're at today. A world in free fall. People's lives turned upside down. And the middle class constantly lied to and then attacked. So, my Monday show is going to be all about that in depth. But we're going to start now by figuring out how do we get from where we were citizens and respected, and we represented the majority of Americans, we meaning the working middle class, from school teachers and nurses and pharmacists to carpenters and bricklayers to police officers and firefighters. We held society together. But we went from being Citizens United to serfs. And so I'm going to play a clip from Professor Victor David Hansen, some of the issues I agree with, some I disagree with. But on this one, you decide what you believe the truth is and call us at 888-874-4888. This is entitled, How the Middle Class is Eroding in America. And that's absolutely correct. And you'll see why in great detail on Monday's show. Let's go to the clip, please.
There was another idea that was very important to the origins of citizenship in the middle class. Society would not then be easily defined by rich and poor, oppressed, oppressor, exploited, exploiter, victimized, victimizer. There was no binary. And most of later Marxist philosophy, remember, or socialism, always tried to suggest that history is a story of the oppressed and the oppressor and class conflict. But constitutional government and citizenship that empowers people and turns them loose to create their own economic futures and trajectories and protects their privacy and protects their property through inheritance and laws against confiscation by the wealthy of the state, that empowers a different group. And when you have that middle different group, then you avoid those simplistic binaries. And that's why almost throughout the philosophical tradition, those on the left cannot stand the middle class. They hate the middle class. They say the middle class is corrupt, or it's materialistic, or it's decadent, or it buys too many snowmobiles, or it buys too many Winnebagos, or it doesn't know how to vote right. But what they're really getting at is the presence of a stable middle class prevents government from getting bigger and bigger and bigger, or from to serve the poor that gets bigger and bigger and bigger, or it prevents people from getting wealthier and wealthier and wealthier. And so the middle class is always attacked by both the poor and the wealthy. There's another idea that comes from the ancient world that's important to remember, that something about being in charge of your own destiny combines the mental with the physical. And by that I mean, in the pre-industrial world, most people were farmers. So they would get up in the morning and they would prune vines, or they would have to plant olive trees, or in the spring, late spring, they would cut grain or thresh it, but it was a constant physical job, but yet they were making decisions. How much manure per acre should I apply? When should I pick the olives? Should I plant more olives or more vines? It was a mental task. And to the Greeks, this combination of mental acuity and physical strength made the perfect balance. Now, we all can't be farmers today. Only 1% of the nation farms, but we have all of these tasks today. The independent trucker, think about it. He has to have endurance to get on that highway for 16, 17 hours, but yet he has to make the decisions. Which job shall I take? How much does diesel fuel cost? That's a very different mentality to driving a truck, let's say, for Amazon. I'm not deprecating driving a truck for Amazon, but I'm saying it's a different activity. And the same thing holds true of the business person. If you work for a corporation, you make very important decisions, but you may not be some hours of the day stocking your shelves, or you may not jump outside on a forklift to deliver the product into your warehouse. But the independent business person is responsible for his own destiny or her destiny, and one mistake can destroy their family. They're not a cog in a corporate wheel. So what I'm suggesting to you is, maybe we can't be all small farmers, or we can't be all middle-class small business people, but we need this group to be present. Because without this present, you do not have these independent voices, and we don't combine the physical and the mental, and we take of people who take responsibility for themselves. Okay, so middle-class citizenship is crucial in the history of constitutional government. Unfortunately, in our generation, it's eroding, and we can see it erode in a variety of contexts. The first is the average middle-class income until 2017 was static for 10 years. For 10 years, average wages of the middle class did not rise. And while home ownership at the millennium at 2000 had reached about 65%. It was as high as it had ever been in the last 50 years. It still was not as high in the 1970s and 1960s and 1950s when it was up to nearly 70%. And now it's declining back down to 60%. Why is that important? Because the house is the modern representation of the ancient farm. It's something that a person owns. They have investments in it. They're attuned to make sure the house is kept up or their investment will be lost. If you have two houses side by side, one you're renting and one you're owning. The one you're renting, you're not going to worry about painting it. You're not going to worry about fixing the roof. You're not going to worry about remodeling. The one that you own are. It's an investment. And that mentality that you're not a renter, you're not a transient. You're stuck in one place, and you're responsible for your community and yourself and your family, and your home is very important. So in the American and Western concept in the modern age, home ownership became the modern equivalent of the ancient farm. And yet today, home ownership is on the decline. There's other measures of middle class decline, and that's per capita wealth. If you look at the average American, when the average American dies, they usually have less than $10,000 in net worth. I should say 50% of the country dies with less than $10,000 in aggregate wealth. That keeps going down in real dollars every year. Over half of Americans die with credit card debt. If you were to take an ancient analysis of that, you would say that essentially large elements of the middle class have now become serfs. They're indentured. They owe someone money that they cannot pay back, and they suffer the consequences. Their buying options are limited. Their choices on how they live are limited. Their chances at home ownership decline simply because they owe a lot of debt. Nowhere is this more dramatic than in student loans. When the federal government, out of good intentions, came into the university and said, we're going to back loans from students so that they can pay your tuition, the whole concept of moral hazard was eroded. The university suddenly said, you mean we can charge tuition higher and higher and higher, and no matter how high we go, you will continue to back a student loan that'll get bigger and bigger and bigger? And the federal government essentially said yes. And so today we have $1.7 trillion in aggregate debt of middle-class children that go to campuses, and what do they find? They find a university that has a blank check to increase and increase and increase board and room and tuition. And why? The teaching loads get smaller and smaller, the number of administrators get larger and larger, and the scope of the university changes. It becomes almost the place of the parent. Your gym may not just be a weight room, it may be a rock climbing wall. Your dorm may not be a dorm, it may be a luxurious apartment. You have a latte bar. You may not just have an administrator for the curriculum, you may have an administrator for equity, inclusion, and diversity. And so the modern university is adding cost and cost and cost onto the elemental challenge of education. And they delude the student into thinking the student is not paying for this because they're taking out a loan and the loan is guaranteed from the government. But when the student graduates, the average loan is somewhere between $30,000 and $40,000. And the interest rates are supposedly subsidized, but as interest rates fell for everybody else, student loans were set by the government, and private banks usually could charge anywhere from 4% to 6% when the actual market rate was about 2%. What am I getting at? We have an entire generation of students that are graduating, often with therapeutic degrees, and are not able to find jobs that would allow them to pay off this enormous debt. If we came from Mars and we looked at this situation, we would just simply say, you have tens of thousands of serfs or indentured servants. If they're not beholden to their credit cards, they're beholden to the federal government and the universities. And it has an effect on the freedom and the viability of the middle class, because there's two or three indices throughout history, especially modern history, that tell us that the middle class is very viable. The first is the age of marriage. When a person reaches his teens and he has a farm, or he inherits it, or he builds it, or he acquires something, then he has confidence, he and she, to get married. Yet the average age of Americans at marriage has gone from about 21 to 29 or 30. The second indices is when you are confident that you're economically viable and you're independent and you can manage your debt and you do not owe 50% of all your debt on a mortgage, then you can have children. And if you have children, this is very controversial, of course, because we're not deprecating people who choose not to have them or can't have them, but investment in something other than yourself, an investment in your country, with the idea that when you die, your values the effort you put into your property, that's going to go to somebody else to have another chance to perpetuate the American idea is very essential. And yet, the age that people are having children, women are bearing children at an average age somewhere between 27 and 29 from 23, 24 a few years ago. And about a third of marriages don't occur to after a child is born. So we've radically redefined childbearing and the age of marriage. There's a third element to this dismal picture, and that is the age of home ownership. That has been delayed substantially. Whereas in the 1950s, people were typically getting married at 21 or 22, having a child 23, 24, buying a house 25, 26. Now home ownership is gone down, as I said, to about 60% of the population, and that's been delayed to mid or late 30s. Think of all of this. Young people coming of age, credit card debt, enormous mortgage debt if they choose to buy a house, marrying later, not having children. What does that do to the nation at large? Well, first of all, it's getting older and it's shrinking. So we have gone in just 50 years from a 2.2 fertility rate to about 1.9. You need about 2.1 to replace yourself. I think all of us everywhere in America think for a second and they'll say, how many brothers and sisters did my parents have? How many brothers and sisters did my grandparents have? What age were they when they got married? What age were they when they bought a house? What age were they when they had their first children? And now look at me. Do I have as many siblings? No. Have I got married at the same age as my parents or grandparents? No. Did I have a child the same age? No. It's again what Alexis de Tocqueville said is prolonged adolescence. And that is, a person comes out of their teenage years, but they have the same mentality that they're dependent and they're not going to grow up and leave the embryo of their family. In other words, in modern parlance, they're living in their basement till their 30s. And you can really see the government's reaction to this. The government today is not necessarily an advocate of citizenship. Reflect a minute on the Obama administration's advertising campaigns to further the expansion of the federal government. They had a commercial called, we call it Pajama Boy, and they were trying to sell Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. And in it, they picked a young man about 24, 23, and they put him in pajamas. The message is, I'm not at work. I may be a man, but I'm wearing child's pajamas. I don't drink coffee. I drink hot chocolate. I don't have to worry about things. I don't have to grow up. And when I worry about, if I were to worry about health care, it's given to me from the government. That was not an isolated case. They also ran another commercial, they being the Obama administration, called The Life of Julia. You may remember it. And it said, let us take us through the life of a young woman. When she's born, free natal care. And then Head Start, free preschooling. And then free counseling. As she goes through education, there's all of these free nutritional programs. There's all of these free legal programs. There's all of these free enhancement programs. When she reaches an age where she wants to go to college, the student loan program kicks in. And there's all of these scholarships guaranteed by the federal government. When she leaves, Julia decides that she wants to have a child. We don't use the word anymore, out of wedlock. She has a child, and guess what? The federal government comes in with nutritional aid and daycare aid, and subsidizes Julia's decision to have one child without being married. The message of these two commercials were then, don't worry about prolonged adolescence. Don't worry about growing up and being an independent, self-supporting middle-class citizen that takes it upon himself to vote and make laws. Relax. Your economic needs, your cultural needs, your political needs, they'll all be taken care of by us, the federal government, and you'll have a wonderful life without any stress. Exactly the opposite message of what the Greeks told us was the key to citizenship.
Okay. some important insights. I'm trying to show that a lot of people don't know what to do right now. They continue to listen to the same broadcasters, promise them an improvement without looking, did it happen? Judge people by what they do, not what they say, because we've become a nation capable of tolerating pathological lies, especially from corporate interest and the government. At what time in life do you say, I've got to grow up and start doing some critical thinking on my own, do some homework on my own, before I decide, whoever it is, are they accurate? Are they telling the truth? It's just like all the media now says there's no connection between vaccines and autism, and the government agency says the same thing, and then we find out there's over 250 studies show just the opposite. Well, now who's right? The peer review independent science that shows there's a connection, or these liars? Well, the liars are right, Gary. We like them. We like how they think. Okay, then that's fine. Just remember, there's a consequence. Okay? So we can produce all the truths, the real truths, the universal truths, but if you're not open to them, if you're still closed, if you're so ideological, rigid, anally retentive, like a cult member, then you're not going to benefit from the truth. And you're sure as hell not going to benefit in the long term by anything the government tells you. Here's another clip, and this is more philosophical. This is also about how they've infused intentionally critical race theory, the new racism, and also identity politics. You mean you're not on our side? Then you're the enemy. Can I have my own opinion? No, you cannot. Can I tell you my truth? We don't care about your truth. Can I make a statement? No, shut up. Or we'll hurt you, and we will hurt you. We control the police, and they're good at hurting people without thinking. I see. So there's no justice. There's no justice. Are you an idiot? It's been captured a long time ago. Just look at what the hell the Obama's able to get, or excuse me, the yeah, Obama also, not even challenged by the media to get back his Nobel Prize for Peace when he destroyed an entire country, Libya. Oh, and also Syria. Oh, forgot about Honduras. Oh, and yeah, and it goes on. Hey, it's Tuesday. Kill this time. That's good. Make sure you kill the right people. We're behind you. Since when is it a good idea to give one person through the National Defense Authorization Act the right to kill whoever they want, take away all habeas corpus, and not a single member of the media will challenge him? Not one. Wow. I didn't realize it was that bad. It's worse than that. Because it's all taking you to some place. You're just not aware where it's taking you. But everything feels fine. I don't feel any grief. You're at the 61st floor, falling in the air. You're not going to feel anything right now. Where do you hit the ground? Then you'll feel it. This is Professor Peter Bohazian and Douglas Murray. Now, what's important is this, is here was a professor of ethics. In fact, he headed the Department of Ethics at Portland University, and he was forced to quit because a couple students didn't like something that was said. They felt triggered. He no longer can work in academia. Why not? What did he do wrong? He didn't do anything wrong. The student was wrong. The administrators were wrong. The equity administrators were wrong. And that's who controls most of our universities today. So how do we get to this place of woke ideology infiltrating every corpuscle of the American psyche? Let's hear what they have to say. Agree or disagree, it's just two different perspectives.
Insert word, studies is set up. Gender studies. And so gender studies isn't merely the study of gender, it's the study of gender. And these fields, and that's really among the most generous thing one could say about them, these fields operate by their own rules. They have their own methodologies. They have their own ways that they advance. So, for example, one thing that they use is lived experience. Mm. In the literature, it's called standpoint epistemology. So we all have our own lived experience, and we need to, a word they're very fond of, privilege certain sorts of life experiences. So we can, I can never, as a cis white heterosexual male, experience the or have access to the lived experience of somebody who's has more oppression variables than I have. Mm. So to understand that, we need a field of study, critical race theory, critical studies, which is just, it's interesting, by the way, at Portland State University, there was an event in which white people could attend but couldn't ask questions. So it was a listening event.
What could possibly go wrong? But telling people to shut up based on their skin color.
First of all, I was amazed that that was legal at a public institution. So a long story short, I found out that it was legal, but it was inadvisable because if you do that, then you could create another event for white people where black people could attend, but they weren't allowed to speak.
One of the most interesting things about this attempt to section off people according to group characteristics, first of all, is that it makes a claim which is self-contradictory on its own terms. It says simultaneously, a group of people cannot understand another group of people because they have not had the same lived experience. And it simultaneously says, but you must devote your life to trying to do so.
Right.
It's what I've described as the, you must understand me, you will never understand me conundrum. But the moral evil, it seems to me, underneath it is this, is that if I cannot understand somebody who's black and somebody who's Asian cannot understand me, and I can't understand a straight person and a straight person can't understand me, and on and none of us who are male can understand women, and so on, then it's unclear how we should aspire to communicate in our lives.
Yeah.
And it's unclear why we would bother to read or talk or think across lines. It says we must be stuck in our silo. Mm. I must only read gay, white, male literature, because although I could try to read literature by other people, it's really not worth it because I'll never understand it. That suggests that we as human beings can never get beyond whatever trait we're born with. It's profound.
We're just going to say goodbye to WBAI that's going over to their news. We're going to continue up to the top of the hour at PRN.live. But we have Bill from Guatemala on the phone. Bill, your turn.
Hey, Gary. How are you? So wonderful to hear your voice, as always. Yes, yeah, sir. So I was going to call in with a question, but I don't really have a question. So I was just going to... just wish everyone well and hope they have a wonderful day and everyone's doing the best they can. And I guess that's about it.
Spread the messages about who we should believe, the media we should trust, and why we shouldn't trust the mainstream media to whoever you can down in Guatemala. Thank you, Bill, for your call. Now let's go back to the clip. Let's go back to the clip.
Reasons. For example, you're gay and I'm straight, but we both know what love is. We both feel love.
And I think there's nothing that either of us cannot understand about the other or their point of view.
Right.
I don't think there's anything you could say that I would say, I can't wrap my head around that because I'm gay.
Right.
And I don't think there's anything I would say that you'd say, I just can't understand what Douglas is talking about, but it must be because I'm straight. It's such, on its own terms, a ludicrous... and
poisonous. It really poisons interactions. But we also know that that's false because we do it all the time. We construct institutions. We go to the bank and make change.
Yeah.
We put in our order for lunch today.
Yes.
We don't know the gender or the sexual orientation of the person who took our lunch. So we certainly we do it with commerce, but we do it with commerce in the broadest sense when we create systems to do these things.
Yes. And it also, of course, It, among other things, makes us retreat into the following problem, which is that if we can't understand each other, it's unclear how we could sort out any problems.
Right.
Other than through violence.
Right.
Because either we can communicate successfully with each other as human beings, or communication is in some way impossible because understanding is impossible, and then what do we have other than violence?
Right.
Now, the thing that they claim to be wanting to avert is precisely the thing that they're most likely to encourage.
Right. And when you think about that, well, what if someone is gay and black? Well, then, right, so there are ever divisions in which you can only communicate more narrowly with people and who share.
Yes, and all of these things, because as you know, the intersectionalists are fascinated by this, aren't they?
Right.
They think there's nothing so interesting right. as finding interlocking oppressions and so on. And this in the identity politics and intersectionalist game is almost the heart of the game because of the assertion that is made that all oppression in human existence is interweaved. That it is all interlocked, and that if you were to address one form of oppression, you would have to address the others. So the intersectionalists say it's not good enough to address remaining misogyny in society without addressing remaining misogyny in relation to black women in society. And then it's not sufficient to address remaining misogyny against black women in society. You must fixate on black trans women in society, and on and on and on. Some of which is interesting, some of which, but it's a long way away from solving any problems because among much else, it says this is so completely interlocked that to unweave it, to unlock it, you would solve something. And my suggestion is you can't, because all of these things are more complex even on those terms. For instance, what do you do with somebody who has some of those characteristics but ducks out from another aspect of it? What do you do about a black woman for whom their femininity is very important to them, but they don't have any interest in black issues? Or they identify as a black person, they'd rather not be reduced to being, you know, a woman. And on and on and on along this way you go. And it seems to me that it's obvious that the intersections don't all resolve and find resolution. They madden people because...
Right.
There are all these tensions which are going to exist anyway.
Imagine taking that upon yourself and thinking that if you think this way, you are a better person. That, to me, is what is particularly maddening. It's the move from thinking about something to feeling it makes you a better person if you have this worldview. If you're constantly looking at people. So when you walk into a store and there's a mixed race couple, that has to command a certain percentage of your attention.
To steal man what they think they're doing, they think that they're correcting injustices that have existed in the past by overcorrecting in the present.
Right.
So they think that because it's undoubtedly true that women have not always historically been able to achieve what they do.
And you can hear the rest of the interview on PRN.live in the archives. So that's our show for today. I want to thank you all for listening. And if you find this of value, share it with others. Also, one quick program announcement. We are looking for a producer who will produce Global Research Hour, which we're very fortunate to be bringing on once a week. And it would be their producers. Yeah, within Global Research, and they have some of the greatest scholars ever who are writing. I mean, I'm looking at the list of the latest news and top stories, and they are really heady. So if you're interested in that, you'll give us a call at 646-926-5422. You'll speak with Sharon and give your information and background if you have experience in producing. You got to have some experience in producing, because it's going to be one of our top shows. It'll be heard all over the world because our audience is worldwide, and it'll be a phenomenal program. Anyhow, that's it for today. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. And remember, tomorrow, the one person who had the courage to call out corruption, dishonesty on a massive scale, that'll be on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day, everyone.